Welcome to the first episode of Herstory. I am your host, Michaela Carney, and I am so excited to talk about spaces women have been a part of throughout history and to talk with some wonderful women of Wheeling doing very wonderful things today. I'm going to start this episode with a big question. What is art? I know, opens up all kinds of debates about modern art and your kids' finger paintings. The sentence conjures up images of Michelangelo's David, Van Gogh's Starry Night. I encourage you to think a little closer to home, though. The quilt on your grandmother's couch, the scarf your mother knit for you. Textile arts, baby. Art we see and use every single day, yet it is so often overlooked. Why? These art forms, dominated by women, are often dismissed as crafts. But my question is, why are the artistic endeavors of women so easily dismissed? Many women I know partake in relentless creativity, unwinding at the end of the day with knitting or embroidery while watching a movie or a TV show. Some have dedicated rooms with spools of yarn and thread. If it were paint or pottery, it would be a studio. But when it is art favored by women, I hear it dismissed so often as a craft room. It is hard to go back and look at when we began beautifying the things we use all the time. People have been adorning themselves for hundreds of thousands of years. As early as the Neolithic period, there is evidence that women spent extra time embellishing fabric. For as long as we have had society, we have longed to make ourselves more attractive, to create everyday items that are more than simply functional. The work of making these practical things beautiful fell squarely upon women. Through the historic delegation of women as those responsible for caring for the home and its residents, textile arts became women's art. The threads that these women weaved often took hours of labor. A quilt can take weeks to create. Crochet work can take 12 to 30 hours or even more. Embroidery work can take hours or even years depending on the scope of the project. The dedication and care taken for arts like this is just one of the reasons we should give them their long overdue flowers. These arts are some of the few where women could thrive for centuries, and are some of the only records of women's creativity and viewpoints for storytelling. Woven into quilts and embroidery and the like are the objects and stories women found relevant. Patricia Minardi, in her essay, Quilts, the Great American Art, said, quote, "Needlework is the one art in which women controlled the education of their daughters, the production of the art, and were also the audience and critics," end quote. Embroidery was one of the few things taught to women in an age where education was not prioritized. Embroidery samplers were often made by young girls as part of a formal education. A basic education was provided in reading, writing, arithmetic, religious instruction, and needlework. Mary DeSilva created one such piece of girlhood embroidery at the Bray Associate Negro School in Philadelphia in 1793. Girls like Mary were taught stitching skills for ornamental purposes, but also for the practical purpose of mending home goods. These were not acts of creativity. Girls were assigned verses or poems concerning life, death, and pious behavior, operating as an additional way to steer intended moral guidance for young girls. Girls who were more experienced would go on to produce more intricate works, like geographical maps or scenes of daily life. Class impacted how much these girls were taught and what they were taught. Wealthy women were taught more elaborate embroideries focused solely on beautifying to showcase genteel status. The majority of girls, out of necessity, were taught with a focus on training for marketable skills for future employment. Dr. Kelly Racine Coles said in her thesis, Schoolgirl Embroideries and Black Girlhood in Antebellum Philadelphia, quote, "The idealized visions of white women and girls creating beautiful needlework within their homes and schools only tells a part of the story of domestic work in the 18th and 19th century," end quote. When women, particularly Black women, were barred from most fields of employment, some financial independence could be found by becoming seamstresses, dressmakers, or milliners. Surviving textiles are some of the only records of women's daily lives across a wide breadth of classes. They preserve individual stories of women's education levels, culture, religion, and social class. Rozca Parker, the author of The Subversive Stitch, said that, quote, "To know the history of embroidery is to know the history of women," end quote. Women also told stories through quilts. Quilts have been utilized as memorials for past family members. Friendship quilts are created by quilting groups coming together to add their own pieces to a quilt belonging to a departing friend so that she may have a tangible memory of her community, working as a practical scrapbook. Double wedding ring quilts operated as visual shorthand for prosperity and love and romance, and were often made by mothers for their daughters. One double wedding ring quilt made by Wilhelmina Minnie Tapp Nolte in Bridgeport, Ohio, was entered in the 1933 Century of Progress International Exhibition at the World's Fair. While she did not win recognition there, Minnie won a ribbon at the Ohio State Fair and regularly displayed quilts at the fairgrounds on Wheeling Island. Quilting was also a social event for many women. Quilting bees, where women would gather in their homes around large quilting frames to create together, became quite popular. The Freedom Quilting Bee, out of Wilcox, Alabama, was born from the Civil Rights Movement as a way for Black craftswomen to earn money for their families. This quilting bee, and the one spawned from it, are credited with sparking the renaissance of quilting in American home decor in the 1960s. Women found a regular community in the textile arts, leading to the creation of clubs and guilds. Wheeling has its own quilting guild, the Fort Henry Peacemakers Quilt Guild. Peace, not spelled like peace and love, but a piece of a quilt, which I think is cute. Quilts found throughout the whole of the Northern Panhandle have a frequent link to Wheeling. Fabric produced by John Ludwig Stifel is suspected to crop up in many preserved quilts from the late 1800s. There are also links that can be found in visual styles of quilts that can connect places like Marshall County, West Virginia, to the likes of Frederick County, Maryland. These can be traced along routes like National Road. An indigo, blue, and white patterned quilt made by one Eliza Jane Luke Daig on a farm in Viola in Marshall County is a perfect example of these cross-state popular patterns. It features a sawtooth border and a section of blue vines and diamond-like repeating blocks. A very similar quilt can be found in Maryland. Work-like quilting was not kept between the two poles of practical use and enjoyable beauty. Quilts throughout times in history have been utilized for political protest. The AIDS quilt is one well-known example. There are beliefs that quilts held code that helped to lead slaves to freedom during the Underground Railroad. While some historians point to the fact that many of the patterns suspected to have been used for the Underground Railroad quilts did not exist at the right times, many Black quilt artists argue for the belief in these quilts. The power that those pieces carry can still be felt today, regardless of what side of the debate you fall on. Quilts have not been the only use of textiles in political history. Suffragettes featured embroidery. The Artists' Suffragette League embroidered over 150 protest banners from 1908 to 1913. They took the traditional feminine art and repurposed it to champion the message for suffrage. The themes set by these women continue through today, as embroidery has found itself an art claimed by feminists as one way to subvert traditional feminine work to broadcast broader political messages. One look at Etsy will show you near endless numbers of feminist embroidery. As skills like these are passed down between generations of women, the link between past and present is very evident. Historian and theologian Carol Christian said, quote, "Like every woman on the planet, I am descended from women who created things of use and beauty with their hands," end quote. When I saw that quote, I knew I had to include it in this. It feels so fitting to help me introduce my first guest. I've been a great fan of hers for a very, very, very long time. I cannot stress how long. Literally my whole life. It's my mom. I'm sitting down with her not just because I love her, but because my mom makes some wonderful embroidery that she sells at art fairs. And I'm so happy to highlight her and get the chance to talk with her about it. So, not for me, because I obviously know who you are, but for everyone else listening, who are you and what do you do?
Corinne Carney, and I'm a stay-at-home mom.
What do you do art-wise?
I embroider, mostly tea towels, sometimes pillowcases.
Could you describe your art form? How long does it take to make a piece?
It takes me about 2 weeks, because unfortunately I have to do housework and deal with children, even though they're all adults now. I trace a design of what I've come up with onto the tea towel, and then I embroider it using the total of maybe 7 stitches that I know.
What made you take up this art in particular versus any other ones?
When I was little, about 5, which would have made my sister about 3, my mom taught us both one stitch, which I've come to learn is called the split stitch. And it's the only stitch I knew for 50 years. Mom would trace something from a coloring book onto a pillowcase, give us the hoop, lock it in for us. We could pick whatever color we wanted, and it kept us busy for hours embroidering. And that's what started it. What restarted it was I tried to do it when my oldest was, I don't even remember what age you were, that I started redoing it, and I couldn't see. My eyes were starting to go. So I put it away, and then the pandemic hit, and I had cleaned the house more than I could possibly clean it. I'd taken care of everything. I had nowhere I could go. So I got the embroidery back out, and I still couldn't see because I remembered why I quit doing it in that middle term. So I ordered a pole light on Amazon that's a magnifying light and went, wow, I can see to do this, and started embroidering again.
What does your creative process look like? What inspires different pieces?
Oh, it's weird. It's usually in the middle of the night when I'm trying to fall asleep. Ideas pop into my head. What would look good on a tea towel? What would people like to have in their kitchens? I've even asked the question on Facebook to other moms and wives, what do you have your kitchen decorated as? And that's where I come up with ideas, and I print off coloring pages that are free to use, and that's what I trace onto my towels with a water-soluble pen. And then from there, I decide the colors, what stitch I want to use, and it takes me 2 weeks at least to get one done.
What are some of the towels that you've made that have been received well? What are some of the ones that people compliment you on the most?
Well, first of all, mostly people come through and they look at them and say, oh, my grandmother did this or my mom did this when I was younger. And that's a lost art. I know which ones are my favorites. My favorites are one I've done with a lantern with glitter thread. It makes it look metallic. I get a lot of compliments on the Hanukkah towels I've done because people say that it's very hard to find Hanukkah gifts. It varies what people are interested in. So I have a variety of different things. I usually don't have two towels of the same exact pattern or design just because I get bored. So I like to change it up.
How do you feel about your art being something that you can use every day? Is it important for you for the towels to be practical?
Yes. I like the fact that it's practical because what restarted the whole thing was I had a set of pillowcases that were halfway done. And I got it back out, and I finished it with my handy-dandy light. And my oldest friend was getting married, so I sent her those pillowcases as a wedding gift. And then I came to think, well, what else can I do? I need something practical. And I thought, tea towels. So I ordered some blank tea towels and just started embroidering them for friends as gifts. And then after that, or towards the end of that, after I'd done all I could for gifts, I looked at my oldest and said, do you think I could sell these? And she says,
and I said, absolutely.
So I started getting them ready to sell.
Do you have any other fun stories about learning this art and connecting with the familial side of this art?
Yes. I've been back into embroidering maybe 3 years. And my dad was digging through his attic and he found his Cub Scout scarf. Back in the day, whenever he was younger, the Cub Scouts would stamp onto, I guess it's a scarf, a necktie, what they earned. And then you would take it home and your mom or your grandmother would embroider it for you. They didn't have the badges like they have now. And my great-grandmother had embroidered 95% of his. Well, then I think he quit, so she just quit embroidering it. And there was one stamp left on there that had never been embroidered and some other things that she hadn't finished. And he gave it to me and said, do you think you could do this? I was so honored, and I still am flabbergasted that I got to finish embroidering something that my great-grandmother worked on. It was tough sometimes to match the colors of the threads that she used, but it was fun. It was fun, and I felt very honored.
I'm leading you with this question only because I know the answer. How did you go about finding, I know that there's a secret cool part of the story about finding the one stamp you couldn't figure out what it was.
Oh, I went over to our neighbor whose son was in Boy Scouts, and I know he helped out with Boy Scouts, and I said, help. I can't tell what colors are on this they're supposed to be, what this stamp is, what it's meant for. So he took pictures of it, and he actually took the scarf, necktie, and took it to a Boy Scout meeting. And he had many different upper echelon people in the Boy Scouts looking at it and trying to figure out what the thing was. And it basically was like a pine cone type thing with pine needles. And I think it was the stamp for doing outdoors work or something. And once he told me that, then I was able to look up some things and figure out the colors and embroider.
Besides your mother and your great-grandmother doing embroidery, are there any other women in your family who have done textile arts like this? Do you have any memories of them doing that?
Yes. Well, not necessarily memories. I know my mom did it, and she was taught by her grandmother, which would be my great-grandmother. I get conflicting answers which great-grandmother taught her. I tend to believe it was on my mom's side. But everybody says, no, she had MS, she couldn't do it. But I have an embroidery box from her that's metal, and it looks like an embroidered pattern on it. I don't know what it's made out of, but this thing's got to be 80 to 100 years old. And I'm also lucky to have a sewing box that I know is 100 years old because my great-grandfather made it from scratch. The other person I know that did this type of artwork was my Aunt Edie, who is my great-aunt. She's my grandmother's sister, and she did more cross-stitch, but I think she did some embroidery after talking to my cousins. And in fact, you have something she made. When one of her daughters was getting married, she had these little tin containers, and she cross-stitched letters on each of them and on a little thing, and then they were glued on top. So everybody that went to that bridal shower got one, and you were old enough to go to the bridal shower, so you have one.
I don't even remember being at that bridal shower.
But it's a little white box, like a little jewelry-sized box to put a ring or something in it.
I also know that there's someone in our family, I don't know who, I'm hoping you'll tell me, that made blankets.
Yes, that would be your other great-great-grandmother on your, my mom's dad's side. She was adopted, my grandfather was adopted, but she taught my mom how to crochet and I believe knit as well. And she made a lot of blankets, and your grandmother made a lot of blankets. And because of that, each of you five grandchildren have blankets that
yes,
your grandmother
I'm
made.
Very excited to inherit mine. Do you think there's any different reaction that your art gets now that they might have got? Do you think that there's any difference?
Yes, because nobody does this anymore, and it is a lost art. And so many people that come through the craft shows say, oh, my gosh, that's a lost art. And do you use the hoop? And I said, yeah, and they're just, you know, amazed how long it takes to do it and that you sit there and you do it all by hand. I mean, there's machines out there in embroider now, but it's completely different by hand.
What legacy would you like your art to leave?
Well, I would like my daughters to learn how to do this.
I knew this was going there.
And
I set myself up for this.
My oldest daughter, she did two stitches one time, and that was the end of that. I would love for my children to know how to do this because once I'm gone, that's it. They'll have, I know, my oldest sitting across from me. Once the one thing I did when I was 5 years old, and the stitches are absolutely ridiculous. It looks like a five-year-old did it, and she wants it to frame it. I don't know why, but...
Yes, please.
Okay.
I think it's cute. Do you see any community of other women who do textile art or art like this?
Other textile art, my best friend, who lived here for 20 years, moved back to Kentucky. She does knitting. She may do crochet, too. And I know she does cross-stitch.
And she also made me a really cool blanket pillow.
Yes. And she made you a scarf, too.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, I don't really have a lot of friends that do this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm.
Have you and Jackie swapped art in any way? Or is there any
No,
sort of-
but she was a big factor in me selling my art because I said, Jackie, I eyeball a lot of this. I don't measure. I don't, and I'm terrible. Like, things on the right side will look totally different than the left side. Like, if I'm doing a wine bottle, don't look at it because it is out of sync. It is uneven. And a lot of things I do are not centered, uneven. And Jackie's the one that said, well, it wouldn't be handmade if it wasn't like that. And that's the treasured part. So...
Yeah, I agree with Jackie. Sometimes you're too hard on yourself, and they're all beautiful. Okay, so textile arts for most of history were arts undertaken by mothers. How does motherhood affect your art?
It interrupts my art. I would like to do it more than I do, but, you know, I get criticized because I'm not cleaning enough or I'm not cooking enough or doing the dishes enough, not by my children.
Yeah, I would never.
it's very interesting that I made each of my children a pillowcase one Christmas, and I literally sat across the room from them making these items, and none of them had a clue that I was making these. They were all, when did you do this? I'm like, when you were sitting across the room talking to me or watching TV with me.
Does motherhood impact the type of pieces you make? I know that you made a piece for a mother. Do you take things like that into account?
Not really, but I try to do pieces that I think people will want, like holiday ones to decorate in their kitchen, or Hanukkah, like I said, or Easter, or different holidays and things like that.
Could you talk about the very cool ones that you made for Jasmine, for her baby?
Oh, yes, yes. Michaela's friend was having a baby, and she knew what the baby was going to be and the initials and everything. And apparently her husband had an embroidered pillow when he was little. So I'm like, I can't do an actual pillow, but I can do a pillowcase, which will make it nicer because then you can throw it in the wash. Again, practicality. So I actually got two baby pillowcases for her to use. And I think I bought her even the pillow to go in with it. And she worked at Later Gator. So I made one that said Little Gator on it for the little girl. And the other one, she sent me pictures of what her husband's pillow had looked like when he was a baby. And I tried my best to kind of match and make it look similar to what his was. So that was fun.
How do you feel about the stitching you do for your art versus things like sewing or mending? Is there anything that connects the two?
Or? Yes, the fact that I have a magnifying light now makes it a lot easier to put a button back on a shirt or stitch a hole in a shirt or something like that. And believe it or not, I am not a good sewer. My mom never hand sewed. She never machine sewed. We just learned how to embroider. I think it was just a way to keep us out of her hair with that one stitch. And I do enjoy doing, like I've made wedding gifts, and I have enjoyed making those, although I get very nervous about them because I want them to be absolutely perfect and absolutely represent what the bride and groom like. Like I'll do their favorite fruit or their favorite flowers or their favorite colors in the artwork.
Well, I can tell you that every single friend of mine that you've made something for always has their stuff out. And every time they come over, they go, hey, remind your mom this is here. So, you know, your stuff is cherished.
I have had people come up to me at the craft shows that said they love my towels, that they wash up nicely, so they're actually physically using them, which actually the towels I get are what's called the old-fashioned flour sacks. They're 100% cotton, and they're great for drying, like glassware.
And not great for when you're cooking with turmeric.
No, nothing in our house is safe from turmeric. Thank you.
Not my fault, I swear. Your art largely started out as creating gifts for people in your life. Can you speak to what it's like to create for those that you love?
It's fun because you try to figure out what would they like or what would they enjoy. I can't sell things that have like the Pittsburgh Penguins on it and stuff because I don't have a right to that logo. But I can give away gifts that have that on for people that are big Pens fans. And the one friend I had to stop and think, like, well, she's not big into hockey or football or anything. What am I going to do? And then I remembered she had pictures on her kitchen wall of, like, seed packs of fruit and things like that. So I did that for her. I try to make it personal for each person and something they'll like and treasure.
What did it take for you to make the move from gifts to selling your art? Less so practically, but more the preparation of merchandising and
my daughter encouraging me and pushing me to, yeah, you can do this. And again, I would lay in bed at night and say, you know what? I could do a watering can with sunflowers in it, or just something would pop into my head. And then the next day I would start on that. And what's funny is I'll come up with new ideas while I'm working on one. And then I'm like, I can't wait to get this one done because I got a new idea and I want to use that. And as far as prepping them for selling them, it's ironing them and getting them all laid out nice and then displaying them. And I'm always nervous every time. I worry whether I'm going to sell any or not.
And yet, it always works out fine.
Yeah, my goal was always to sell at least three so I at least pay for my table. And by the way, I don't consider it artwork. I just consider it something fun to do.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that there's any reason that this artwork this type of artwork might be seen as less serious than painting or sculpting?
Because a lot of the things I do are less serious. Like I did one with Santa stuck in the chimney with two elves on either side. I just want something that's going to make people smile.
That's art, baby. If you feel, then that's art.
I've always said I was craft impaired. And I still feel I'm craft impaired because, like I said, things are not even, they're not equal, and I just, oh well, let's hope it sells.
And they do. You've been contracted, might be the wrong word, but you've been hired to do some specific towels.
Yes.
What's that like?
That was stressful, beyond stressful. I wanted it to be absolutely perfect, and they wanted so much on it. And I can't tell you the threads I ripped out and redid and ripped out and redid. And it just, it was very stressful. In fact, after I completed that and gave it to them, I put down embroidery for a while. It just took all the fun out. It took the wind out of my sails. It actually literally took the fun out of it. My dad always said, if you make something like when he used to make dollhouses for his granddaughters, people would say, why don't you sell these? These are so nice. He says, that'll take the fun out of it. Then it becomes a job. And that's the, I didn't like that. I don't ever want to do that again. I enjoy coming up with my own ideas and showing what creativity I have.
Okay. That's the end of my questions. Is there anything else that you want to say about embroidery?
I wish my daughters would do it.
So, women making art, a wonderful thing. The labor and love that goes into these projects, I just adore it. If you want to know more about textiles and wheeling, go ahead and go to Wheelon, where we have an article posted all about that. If you want to see some very cool feminist art involving textiles, you should look at Judy Chicago's The Dinner Party. That's just a plug that I needed people to look up. I love it. I would also recommend looking at the Museum of the Home. While it is in London, they have a fabulous website where you can learn about all kinds of wonderful textile arts and home arts. If you want to learn more from Wheeling Women and learn a bit more about history, tune in next week. It's going to be delicious.